Good afternoon and welcome to the FCC. I hope you're all enjoying your lunch. Just a note ahead, on Wednesday, we will have Professor Michael de Gaulier and Professor Sonny Lowe talking about the upcoming district council elections, and just basically a survey that they've carried out to see what local voters are thinking about this, how they see their political future. So that's Michael de Gaulier and Sonny Lowe on Wednesday. It's with great pleasure that I introduce Chan Kun Chung. Many of you will already be familiar with his work. He's living, of course, for a number of years in Beijing, but has kindly come down to talk to us and also to promote his latest book, The Fat Years. The Fat Years constitute a first on two fronts. One is that it's been translated into at least English at this point, but I think probably other languages. And whereas his previous dozen books are fine for Chinese readers. But it's also his first book involving science fiction. So it's less about Chinese tragedy and more looking at science fiction and politics in the future. And it's also about how a month goes missing on official records. Now, Chan Kun Chung he said to me he just writes books these days, which I would imagine is a full-time job, but he's also a journalist, a novelist, as I say, an environmental activist. He's a founder member of Green Power. He's also been a screenwriter and a film producer and was the founder of City Magazine. So let's give a warm welcome to Chan Kun Chung.
Hello, or as they say in Beijing, 大家好. I'm Chan Kun Chung. I was born in Shanghai to a Ningpoese family, and I moved to Hong Kong when I was 4 years old. Until I was 40 years old, essentially I spent all my time in Hong Kong studying, working, except for a brief period in studying abroad and travel and leisure. In 1976, I worked for the now defunct tabloid paper, The Star, under Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Parwani. Probably some of the old timers may still know them. And then I stayed there for 9 months, and then I started my magazine, City Magazine, in 1976. I was its publisher for many years until it was sold, and now it belonged to a Shenzhen, Guangzhou-based magazine company. And before 1992, I was involved in various businesses, and then that year, I went to China, trying to work for some Hong Kong money to invest in Chinese cultural businesses. And that was my serious involvement in mainland China. And I've been relocated to Beijing since year 2000. As many of people from outside of mainland China, over the years, I was always told that we Hong Kongese or others can never understand China. China is too complicated for outsiders. So I was told that. So it took me many years to feel confident that maybe I can write about China. In recent years, I'm getting more and more confident because I started to feel that perhaps mainland Chinese will not understand China also, because there are so many versions of interpreting China now, and they conflict with each other, and they fight with each other. So if then they can't all be right, in that case, I'm trying to offer my version as an outsider on what it is in China. But essentially, I moved out of Hong Kong in 92 and never work again in Hong Kong. So I've been in mainland China and a brief period in Taiwan, and then completely relocated since year 2000. And I I wrote this book in the earliest months of 2009, because I conceived of this idea of writing a political book, a political novel on China in year 2008. That was the year that was very impactful to me, starting with all the events from Tibet, from the torch traveling in the world, to the Olympics, to the major earthquake in Sichuan, and then the global economic meltdown. I would think the mentality of many Chinese changed that year. The authorities' way of behaving also evolved after that year. And that gave me the idea of writing something. But since at that time, I thought people may not agree to what I see, what I saw about China in the year 2009. So I pushed back the book to set it in a not too distant future of 2013, so I can build in some fictional events to explain what I tried to say about year 2009. One of the conceit is in year 2011, the world went through another global meltdown, a double dip, and China again managed to emerge unscathed and become stronger and wealthier as a result. So by year 2013, most Chinese are quite happy with what they are seeing inside China, except for the few very stubborn persons who still try to remember certain things. And one of the things is in the book, in year 2011, there was a month of reign of terror. But miraculously, most Chinese by year 2013 did not remember a thing about it. They generally forgot about it. So that was the context of the book. And then I have this, building this love story and I think, but that's the context. I was trying to say that after year 2008, things changed. One of the things that changed is, we were discussing China become more confident, but it didn't stop them from becoming more repressive in certain areas. As a matter of fact, I would think civil liberty, due process, and freedom of expression regressed since 2008. I was traveling for a few days. I prepared my words before that, and again, new things are happening. I was reading the Tribune in Singapore, Pearl Harbor Tribune in Singapore, but that was the headline story with Yan Lianke, another very prominent Chinese novelist, on the front page about being evicted from his villa near Beijing. But there are other stories, of course. By the unnerved by its chatty internet, Beijing is set to step in. So it will be more control over the internet and the microblogs, China's Twitter. I would think there will be more policy on these things. I wrote it, these words, before the announcement by the state to step up the control. So I could be too soft on China in this. It could be worse. Well, first-time visitors may be amazed to find that China is more pluralistic, vibrant, and orderly than they have imagined. It also appears to be as free as any other free country. These impressions are not wrong at all, though, as we all know, there are more to meet the eyes. I'm not prepared to go into details on the many known predicaments of China. It is never easy to manage a big developing country in an age of globalized instability, not to mention pulling off the balancing act of growing a mixed economy with Chinese characteristics by a party state with socialist pretense. But even a capitalistic, Leninistic state cannot be ruled by just delivering economic growth plus coercion, though it takes a good dosage of both. It needs to make two more moves. It needs to fabricate make-believe stories about its legitimacy, and it needs to quiet its dissenters. Legitimacy means many people accept that the one-party rule is worthy of supporting, and quieting dissent means its legitimating stories will go unchallenged. That is what I try to talk about here, how the Chinese state quiets dissent and engineers legitimating make-believes, or how its thought control mechanism operates in this age of consumerist abundance and putative easy access to information. I shall argue that it is precisely this consumerist abundance and easy access to information that makes the selective repression of the sometimes ruthless Chinese state not only less easy to be perceived, but often more effective. In my novel, The Fat Years, I have one of its protagonists avers that now Chinese have enjoyed 90% freedom. What more do we want? In terms of freedom of employment, travel, education, marriage, cultural expression, access to information, consumer options, etc., China now is a much freer place, not even when compared to the totalitarian monocultural years under Mao Zedong, who died in 1976, but also to the post-cultural revolution and the first phase reform and opening up years from 1976 to 1992. This must be considered a major improvement. I must hasten to add there are systematic discriminatory constraints on the freedom of relocation against the farming class. China is now connected to the world and is, shall we say, a 90% open society. Hundreds of English and European books are translated into Chinese and published every year. Chinese netizens can go online to read the New York Times and the Guardian, though they are barred from the Chinese internet firewall, from reaching social media such as Facebook and Twitter, as well as many websites outside of China. Still, China is a far cry from the kind of bleak, totalitarian dystopia depicted in George Orwell's 1984, where one cannot find a simple commodity like a razor blade. Unlike in 1984, where one is constantly watched and strictly disciplined, now the post-totalitarian Chinese state allows. It is always the state allows 90% freedom, maybe even more. It is a subjective literary expression, not quantifiable statistics. That means all the state has to do is to control the remaining 10%, or maybe less. This is the magic of 90% freedom and 10% unfreedom. In a totalitarian command economy of scarcity, many people are aware that they have been deprived. But in a capitalistic, Leninistic economy of abundance, it is only human most of us would not invest our energy in search of the repressed. Most young people would probably feel they are free to access any information. It is all a click away. They even master the art of climbing over the internet firewall and play a cat and mouse game with the net police or the net nannies. But maybe they don't know what they've missed. The 10% or less unsaid, the 10% or less unfreedom of speech, things that were not taught at school, not covered by the media, not on thousands of printed books and hundreds of Chinese websites inside the internet firewall. Everything one is not exposed to during one's formative years. Even the older generations who know of these unsaid dare not tell the young, lest they may mess up their children's mind or even get them into trouble at school. A huge political and historical knowledge gap took place between generations. New information may have posed a challenge to the control-happy state. Microblogs, for instance, are not possible for the state to censor in real time. young microbloggers invariably will encounter microblogs they have read moments ago, or even their own postings being deleted. Then they may realize that Big Brother is alive and well and watching after all. That may be the beginning of some political awareness, but to the largest extent, most microblog postings are not about politics, and the availability of this avalanche of microblogs at any moment contributes to the sense of 90% freedom. So the mix of 90% freedom and 10% unfreedom. That's the effect, a stifling of the desire to search for censored information by overwhelming you with enough tolerated information that caters to almost every taste. I must say this exercise of unrelenting thought control, combining consumerist freedom and censorship, is effective and paying its dividend. Since I first lived in China in the early 1990s, I can tell now more and more people are quite content to indulge themselves in things that they can do that would not get themselves into trouble with authority. Chinese students studying abroad may even show their disbelief when you try to present dissenting facts to them. While there are thousands of mass incidents, protests from unhappy crowds every year, I think it is not far wrong to say, compared to the 90s, there are more, not less, buy-in on the desirability of the one-party rule. Now one may ask, so what? Isn't it true people forget things everywhere, and every country tries to educate, read, brainwash its young? True, collective amnesia and indoctrination happen everywhere all the time. The difference is, in some countries with better freedom of speech, those who remember or hold a contrarian view can make a fuss and shout out loud. Then there is a chance. As a popular Chinese saying goes, don't forget the past, for it is a lesson for the future. Admittedly, even within the 10% or less unfreedom, maybe only a fraction of it, say 3%, are absolute taboos. For instance, wearing a white shirt, or worse, holding a bundle of flowers in the Tiananmen Square on the June 4th will get you arrested, because the Tiananmen protest of 1989 is still an absolute taboo. Even if you write something to praise the government for the massacre in many parts of Beijing, I think it won't get published as of now, but it may if the regime turns more aggressive. Those who challenge the A-list in words will be silenced pretty soon. Those who do it in action will be facing the state's huge security apparatus. We must understand that in China, whether you are a dissident or not, is really not up to you. It is up to the state. If the state decides to persecute you, then maybe your friends and the outside world will label you as a dissident. Before the state takes the initiative, you are only a critical citizen trying to exercise your constitutional rights of free expression. The big name dissidents may be noticed by the international community, but most are nameless and faceless, except perhaps to a few human rights groups. The plight of Tibetan and Uyghur dissidents are generally worse. Apart from the A-list, the rest is different shades of gray. In the gray area of non-freedom, the state has become more sophisticated and more selective, and some would say more effective in handling dissents. The propaganda bureaucrats give both regular and ad hoc instructions to the news media on what can be said and what cannot, often verbally, so it will not leave a paper trail. Most media and publishing houses follow instructions and routinely do the self-censorship to avoid trouble. The private sector portal that operate microblogs employ hundreds of corporate net nannies to delete unsavory contents. But there are always intrepid journalists, publishers, documentary makers, and netizens to rush to spread information under the radar or before the state put on a red light. They call it braving the yellow light. The authority is not only into censorship, sometimes it is proactive in building a version of truth. Recently, I was directed to take notice of the microblogs of the daughter of a victim of a major speed train accident. She microblogged the bad treatment of her seriously wounded mother suffered at the hospital after this accident. Immediately, he was overwhelmed by microblog attacks. The follow-up microblogs all defended the rescue operation and the post-accident treatment of victims, that one can't help feeling it could only be orchestrated. Now the state is rich in money, in tax money, in the academia and the news media, where many are, in fact, state employees. Those who show their loyalty will be handsomely rewarded, and those who criticize the authority will not get a promotion, will not receive any state grants, and could be sacked. The once untamed movie directors, documentary makers, avant-garde artists, and writers can be won over by financing their projects and inviting them to become fellows at prestigious state-sponsored academies and trade guilds that offer perks, fame, and probably more important to some of the already established people, a formal lot of approval from the country, the authority in the country. Of course, the old way of using informers and putting dissidents under surveillance, house arrest, and imprisonment are not out of fashion. The gray area is where the awkward squad, to use historian Julia Lovell's phrase, usually operates. In spite of state discouragement, there are still a sizable squad of right lawyers, civil activists, investigative journalists, public intellectuals, and critical academics, in addition to righteous citizens, trying to get as much mileage as possible out of this gray area to critique the state and the party, report the suppressed news, and tell their versions of truth. Those who tap the gray area would have to make sure they do not step over the baseline, the threshold to state intolerance. Some are getting so good at it that they think they understand the modus vivendi and could maintain a safe distance from the baseline until the state decides otherwise. The baseline shifts from time to time. One worrying trend that calls for attention is that it is generally agreed that since 2008, the signposts of the baseline again shifted toward less tolerance. Compared to the decade or so before 2008, there are less freedom of speech, due process, and civil liberty now. According to personal reports from rights activists and dissident writers who have been incarcerated in the last 1 year, physical torture has returned. This is a really bad sign, a throwback to the more thuggish, extra-legal past. Now, may I ask, with China becoming a major world power, why would the state still try so hard to quiet or even persecute the dissenters to begin with? Why can't it just relax? I think the rationale is something like this. The Chinese Communist Party claims to represent the nation and the people. The CCP thinks it is entitled to stay in power forever. Some sense of legitimacy helps. CCT's legitimacy is built on a bundle of closely guarded stories that it can deliver economic growth and the stability that such growth relies on, that such stability can only be achieved by the CCP monopoly of power. And that is justifiable because the CCP claims a proven record of saving China from foreign imperialism and leading the nation to overcome all crises. In short, aside from a few hiccups, the CCP has always been right. Therefore, it is a good bet for all Chinese that the CCP alone, which now is only communist in name, can lead China to further prosperity and a glorious national revival. There lies the CCP's legitimacy, and don't anyone dare to say China has other options. And don't anyone dare to point out their bureaucratic incompetence and the much-hated corruption and abusive use of power among the ruling elites, their families, and cronies, or dwell on CCP's past atrocities and failures. To uphold this story, the CCP needs to be very particular on how it is remembered. There could be only one version, the party-endorsed version, and on how it is perceived now, again, only the party-censored version. Well, truth is inconvenient, and therefore censorship is unavoidable, and selective forgetting helpful. That is why history, memory, political ideologies, current affair coverage, and public policy discussions all become sensitive areas, and the state is in a perpetual watch-out to silence the squad of recalcitrant citizens who insist on telling their versions of truth. Thank you.
Well, my thanks to Chan Kun Cheng. We've got microphones going out if people, I'm sure there are many, have questions. Are they going? Can't see any
microphone. While we're waiting for people to warm up, I'd just like to ask, how representative is a story about Beijing of what's going on in the whole country? We were chatting earlier about local issues in Shandong that the central authorities pretty much ignore. China's got a lot of provinces, a lot of powerful local elites.
Well, one doesn't have to be in Beijing to know about China, of course. But also, we are very aware that there's no one panoramic sightseeing point that we can see through China. That didn't exist. So Beijing's not the only place. But it is, for me, a better place when compared to Hong Kong. That is why I moved to Beijing.
Ted Thomas. 1325 FCC. I am publishing in the next two or three weeks or so a new, completely fresh approach on the life and thoughts of Confucius. Now, when I started this a couple of years ago, Confucius was very much in favor. In fact, the Chinese named their Peace Prize because the problems with the Nobel Peace Prize as the Confucius Prize. I'm now beginning to hear whisperings that that's not the case. To what extent is the Chinese government committed to reverting to something the Chinese have done for 2,500 years, following the thoughts and the philosophies of Confucius? And in the event that they're not, are they likely, in view of what you've just said, to resist the publication of a new life and a completely fresh look at Confucius? Thank you.
Thank you. First, I know no national secret, so I don't know how the state really is thinking about this. But I would think that the general trend is to tap into the traditional value and the imperial legacy of pre-modern China, more and more so. Let me try to give you an example. In the old story, for instance, that was presented in one of the earlier artwork, Dongfang Hong, East is Red. After the 49, they have this huge staged drama, Dongfang Hong. In it, the theme is about class struggle against the capitalist. It's about getting rid of China, how communists help China to get rid of its feudal past, and then to fend off the foreign imperialists. That was the theme. But in year 2009, on the 60th anniversary, they again staged this again another huge drama on stage and promoted to everyone. In that thing, the only theme is a national revival from 150 years of foreign humiliation. Class struggle was gone. Chinese imperial past was, in a way, considered positively. And China, the role of Chinese the Communist Party is to lead China to its revival, national revival. That shift in the story, the narrative, the official narrative, indicated probably certain aspects of Chinese tradition will be emphasized much more than now. There are storytelling of reinstating, I mean, Confucian Institute is everywhere. So Confucian, I think, is pretty safe, the publishing Confucius in China. He's not a controversy anymore. Though they may not put his statue at Tiananmen Square, they removed the statue after a while. But I would think that they're okay. Even the Manchu Qing dynasty was reinterpreted recently to show that this regime is the legitimate heir to this imperial Qing dynasty.
Thanks for your talk. How would you describe, what would you say now is the governing ideology of the People's Republic of China? Because I'm always struck when you have visiting members of parliament and so, who come from foreign countries, who come to China and sit across the table from the Chinese counterpart in Beijing, how normal it is, how much they engage with them on the same basis as they would with their French counterpart or their counterpart from South Africa. And yet China is, there is a very big difference at a deeper level. So, if you took a Chinese Communist Party member and put them in the United States, Australia, or Western Europe, where would they sit on the political spectrum? Where would they fit in?
There are 80 million members. I'm sure they are spread all over the political spectrum now. Depends on what post they have. As they have the saying that where you sit determine how you think in China. So for those who are benefiting from this kind of crony market economy, probably they are more like a neoliberal American Wall Street person. Could be things like that. But there are also other members who are in charge of promoting red culture, remembering the Mao legacy. So they would talk about different things, probably. That's the Chinese characteristics. They are both true, both the left and the right at this moment. They're still using and clinging on to the Mao legacy, certain part of Mao legacy. In technical term, I call it the right-wing Maoism, in contrast to the left-wing Maoist who insists on equality and things like that.
Sorry, I meant to say at the beginning, if you could just introduce yourselves and say
My name
you
is Kian Ng. I'd be interested to hear your views on how you think if China, the Communist Party, would ever be replaced, and what is the likely scenario for that to happen? Because I'm just thinking, over the 2,500-year history of China, the feudal past, the general history is roughly about 200 years for each dynasty. And usually, if you look at the past history, the first 60 years or so, flourishes very, very well. And it's usually, towards the end when there's decline and corruption and, the general folk can't take it anymore, and then the dynasty falls. So I'd be interested very much to hear your view, please.
though I wrote this sci-fi fiction, I'm not very good at predictions. My Bible was entitled "Sheng Shi" in Chinese, meaning the age of prosperity or age of ascendancy. In the past, when people use "Sheng Shi," it's used to describe certain period of prosperity in Chinese history. For instance, the Han, Tang, Sheng Shi, or during the Qing time, the Kang, Xi, Qianlong, Sheng Shi. Well, that could last for many, many years, okay? But also, all the seeds of decline was built in the Sheng Shi. For instance, in Han Dynasty, it was the Han Wu Di, the very militarist emperor who conquered many territories. That was called Sheng Shi. But after that, it was major decline. So I would think, now Chinese are calling this time Sheng Shi. It's everywhere. These two characters were used everywhere now. So we are living in a Sheng Shi. The last time we call ourselves living in a Sheng Shi is probably in the 19th century. So Chinese hasn't been calling ourselves Sheng Shi for more than a century. Now we are doing that again. So probably some changes will be coming, because Sheng Shi means the peak of certain thing, then according to Chinese philosophy, it bounds to change.
Hi, my name is Martin Higgins. Thank you for your eloquent speech and also for your very profound book. I was just wondering, given what you say in your book, and what you've just said here, have you had any reaction from officials in Beijing? And my second question is, how long do you think you can continue to live in Beijing?
The second question first, I relocated completely to Beijing. I even moved all my books from several locations into China, which is a huge headache. That shows my determination to live in Beijing. I have no other plans to move. The authority never came to me after the book was published in Hong Kong and Taiwan. The book was not published in China. After it was published in Hong Kong and Taiwan, many mainland publishers came to me. I told them to read the book first and we talk, and they never came back. So it was not published. And it's a novel and about the future. So maybe, I don't know what happened, but somehow, nothing happened to me. At least I'm not aware of it. But somebody trying to sell the book online at Chinese eBay type website like Taobao, they went into trouble. Their shops were closed after a few months of selling because they are selling this book. So I cannot tell whether I cannot even tell whether it's banned or not because it's never published. But there's a discussion group on one of the book sites called Douban. That site was closed down too. Whether it's they were hinted by the authority or the website owners do it to protect itself, I don't even know.
If I could ask a question, you were saying in your talk that it's probably a 90%. And then 10% of awkward dissenters. Do you think there is a possibility over the next decade or so that dissidents will become fewer and fewer?
I'm always worried that will be the case. The control is getting more sophisticated and effective all the time. And the recent reporting is that they are not happy with their control. They want to be more effective in it. So for the past few years, internet and microblogs open up a lot of space for uncontrollable information. That window may close, at least constrained. If the bloggers, say, have to register their name and their ID card, before they can open an account. Things may change. And the Chinese are very savvy at in these technological or the technological side. I have trouble all the time trying to go on Google searching, but it's not blocked, but it's so slow, you have to give up on Google. So they have all kinds of toolboxes to deal with these things. So it's getting more and more difficult. I was very pessimistic in the novel, which said only a few small fish dissidents are still allowed to operate anonymously in the cyberspace.
Yes, over here.
I'm with Lim Advisors, a fund manager here in Hong Kong. Have you noticed any change as to how the Chinese authorities control dissidents or manage them since the onset of the Arab Spring, particularly since they've been caught out backing the wrong team in Libya?
Major changes, as I've said, started in 2008, and especially during the Nobel Peace Award to Liu Xiaobo. Many dissidents were arrested, not because of, at the time of around the announcement and also around the real ceremony in Oslo. And one of the very known dissidents were arrested on the second day of the announcement of, ceremony. And he was physically tortured. Badly tortured, he has to be sent to the hospitals. That is something new, because for many years we would think the authority would not physically torture a known dissident. They could put him into prison or a house arrest or whatever. They would not torture him. And this person and the family did not spread the news out at all until probably April this year. That has a very frightening effect on the dissident community, if there's one, because they would think the rules of the game has changed. So, but during the African incidents, another round of arrests happened. True, many artists were arrested, but. Again, I mean, this time, most of them are not physically tortured. So it really depends on which department or ministry is dealing with which dissident, apparently. But in general, dissidents were not tortured, but some suffered seriously. But this guy, when he recovered and try to tell his closest friend about it, that become more effective in a way. The word spread in Beijing. And I think it really quieted down a lot of known dissidents at this moment. They are less active because of this.
Yeah, if we could have just one last question.
Hugo Restall, Wall Street Journal. Related to that, do you feel that the Arab Spring and other color revolutions, we know the Chinese government is very afraid of them and reacts to them, but does the news of that permeate down into Chinese society and have a palpable effect on people's thinking about whether there is an alternative to the Chinese Communist Party?
I think that Arab Spring sends a signal to the Chinese authority to improve on their control techniques and policies. I'm not sure whether the thousands of mass incidents that the protests were inspired by the Arab Spring. Probably they are more concerned with their interests being infringed by corrupt officials and their cronies than by a kind of a democratic pursuit for an alternative China? I would not think so. Though there are a few, there are some people who would try to take this opportunity and make a case out of it. That's not my feeling. Most people did not know what's happening, probably. Or if they know, they're not very focused on it. But even for those incidents, the mass incidents, most are not inspired by the Arab Spring at all.
Okay. Our thanks to Chan Kun Chung for a very interesting talk and question time today. Chan Kun Chung is available for a chat afterwards, so if you've got any follow-up questions. His book, The Fat Years, is also available outside. And on behalf of the FCC, here's a gift from us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here against me, pack up.